journey, basically, in her life.
Good morning, everyone. I love how many people are in the room. I love the energy in the room. Hopefully, the extra hour of sleep has done everyone a world of good. I am Thais Carter. I am one of the members of the Adult Education Committee, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you as we continue our LinkedIn Learning series on women in the Old Testament. We are so fortunate to have with us today Leslie Vernelson, who is a Democracy Fellow at Interfaith America through a postdoctoral partnership with Princeton Theological Seminary, and a scholar of the Hebrew Bible Old Testament. Her forthcoming book with Oxford University Press is Fruit of Her Hands, Women, Work, and Society in the Hebrew Bible. She has taught classes for master's and undergraduate students at PTS, Princeton University, Mercer University, Union Theological Seminary, and Union Presbyterian Seminary. She has also served as the interim director of the Center for Theology, Women, and Gender at PTS from 2020 to 2023, organizing events and curricula to educate public and scholarly audiences on the intersections of religion and gender. And the thing that I want you all to know about Leslie, and I think this has been true of many of the women who have been in front of you to present on this topic so far in the series, is she is the real deal. This is not just a scholarly pursuit for her. She cares deeply about the role of women in the church, and that shows up in everything that she does. And so I'm so grateful that she has given us time this morning. So before we turn things over to Leslie, please join me in prayer. God, it feels like fall this morning. The crispness in the air, we hope, God, we can bring into this space with a crispness to our minds in the ways that we engage with your word and the stories of women in the Old Testament. God, we are so grateful for the opportunity to learn from them, to learn from one another, and to continue to work together, God, to think and pray about how you want us to be in the world. God, in the midst of a crazy, chaotic season in history, we pray, God, that you would help us to look to the past and find ways to continue to be strong people of faith in the present. In your name we pray, amen.
Amen. Thank you so much, Thais, for that very kind welcome, and to everyone here for welcoming me. I'm very excited to talk about reading Ruth with you this morning, but I'm gonna start, before I start talking, by tossing out a question. Maybe talk to someone next to you for a moment. How do you think the book of Ruth fits into the canon of the Hebrew Bible, or the Bible more generally? So, did anyone's seatmate or partner share something that you would like to lift up and share with us? Maybe a couple of groups? Okay. How does Ruth fit into the canon?
I believe that Ruth is in the canon because her situation neutralizes all those places where it says not to associate with foreigners.
Yeah, it's a powerful statement, right? Of ethnic inclusion. Other groups?
Coming back, Francis, I'm coming back.
Well, I started out in our group saying it doesn't fit with anything, but I think it's in the canon because of the lineage.
Yeah, it is kind of an anomalous story. It's a genre that maybe we're not quite sure. And certainly, the book does have an important note at the end that connects it to, right, the lineage of David. All right, so here's my roadmap for what I'm going to talk with you about today. And really, I'm going to make you talk a lot too. So get ready. So we'll talk about genres and how they encode our values. We'll talk a little bit about how Ruth exemplifies navigating religious and ethnic boundaries. We'll talk about how Ruth exemplifies navigating gendered opportunities and constraints. And then we'll wrap up with some final thoughts on Ruth. So I wanted to start by thinking about the genre of Ruth and thinking about how we think about genre. So has anyone read Elena Ferrante's? I'm so glad. She's one of my favorite authors. So for those who know Elena Ferrante's work, she writes beautifully. She writes these complex narratives about often about women in very particular places and spaces in sort of mid-20th century Italy. But when her books were translated into English, there was a controversy over the covers of her novels. Some bookstores, a handful, even chose to cover up the covers of her novels on their shelves because they felt a certain type of way about it. So as we look at these covers, what type of book does this look like? Romance, we might call it chick lit, something like that, right? And so that's what the controversy was. For people who were unhappy about the covers of these novels, they were unhappy because Elena Ferrante writes complex literary books. But it's also true that Elena Ferrante writes about women. There's marriages in her stories. There's women and children at the beach in her stories. And so this controversy sort of led to a set of reflections about what's so bad about being classified as chick lit, right? Is it mutually exclusive to write about women and to write complex literary narratives? So I thought about this when I was thinking about Ruth and thinking about the title of your series, which is taken from Dr. Sackenfeld's book, Just Wives. And I was thinking about how often our genres and the way we think about genres can reflect some of our readerly values. Now, genre is also a way of categorizing things. We have to categorize things to make our way in the world, right? Genres can reflect sort of family resemblances and help us understand how different books are related to each other. But I have a quote up here from Rebecca Solnit, who writes, "A book without women is often said to be about humanity, but a book with women in the foreground is a women's book." So I want to have this in the forefront of our mind as we think about Ruth, and as we think about the themes of Ruth and the story of Ruth, how often we think of women's books as sort of niche categories, and other books as sort of general, right? So just to say a little bit about the genre of Ruth, it's part of an emerging genre in ancient literature, the Jewish novella. So other examples would be Esther, or the beginning of the book of Daniel, the first half of it. And it's this sort of emerging genre in Second Temple literature that often includes stories of women, and that these stories kind of have a long time ago and far away sort of aspect to them. Does anyone remember when the book of Ruth is set? You're welcome to pull out if you, or not. If not, that's fine. It's set when the judges ruled Israel. It's kind of a long time ago. We sort of have an idea, but it's not grounded in a specific year or something like that. So this is sort of the book of Ruth. And now I'm going to ask us to reflect together. I know that you in small groups have talked about the book of Ruth already, but I want to focus in on some themes in the book of Ruth of navigating ethnic and religious boundaries. So within the book of Ruth, and maybe we'll just have people call out answers for this one, what elements tend to define identity and communal inclusion? Feel free, if you have a Bible with you or on your phone, to pop it up. Come again. Money can, yeah, definitely define communal inclusion, right? Can you say a little more?
Well, the whole thing about inheritance.
Yeah, inheritance is a key theme of the book, right? Who inherits what, where the money and land goes. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Worship?
Yeah, worship. Can you say a little more? Yeah, communal engagement is a definition of worship. And in what ways do we see, maybe if we think about the beginning of Ruth, I like this point about worship as being sort of definitive. Would someone maybe volunteer to read this aloud for our group? Maybe Thais?
Or? Oh, I was going to hit the microphone.
So she said, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, do not press me to leave you, to turn back from following you. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do thus to me and more as well, if even death parts me from you.
Thank you so much, Virginia. Virginia, right? Okay. So how do we see sort of definitions of inclusion and identity maybe in this passage? So what elements are defining identity here? Yeah, one's God, right? And we see Ruth making a choice, right? Your God shall be my God, after her mother-in-law Naomi says, go back to your people and your gods.
Geography,
absolutely. Yeah, place. So Ruth and Naomi in this passage are in the land of Moab, and Ruth is saying, I will come with you back to Bethlehem. So geography is strongly determinative.
Family ties too.
Yeah, absolutely, right? So Naomi says to Ruth, go back to your people, right? But Ruth says, your people shall be my people.
Well, the first time I read this, I thought, get away, you know? I'm trying to get alone. I'm trying to have some solitude.
Mm, identifying with Naomi.
You know, that's Naomi saying, Ruth, come on. Mm-hmm. You know, go get your own friends.
Go get your own friends.
What are you doing hanging around me?
Yes, and she says to her, are there still sons in my womb that you could have another husband, right? And, you know, even if she could have another child, it wouldn't be the right age for Ruth to marry, is part of her point there as well. I also noticed that burial is included, right, which can be a significant religious and social tie, right, where you're buried, can say something about your community. So there's some ways that the book of Ruth talks about the complexities of navigating ethnic and religious boundaries. So in what ways could we think of Ruth becoming an insider in Bethlehemite society throughout the book from your reading this week? Yeah, she's admired. Boaz talks about how he's heard about her loyalty to her mother-in-law. She's held up as an example. Yeah, she's perceived very favorably, right? She acts courageously. I think we've already mentioned this morning that she's listed in a very significant genealogy. So she's the ancestor of David, right? Who else is she then the ancestor of? Jesus, if we're thinking about the whole Bible. So a pretty significant genealogy. Are there ways that we could think about Ruth being an outsider at various points in the story? at the beginning or even maybe at the end.
From the narrator's point of view, Moab, 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 Moab.
Yes, she's Ruth the Moabite, right? And I think this points to a sort of complexity, right? Even though she's part of the story, even though she's part of this significant genealogy, she's continually called Ruth the Moabite, right? And I think that points to a tension that can be felt for immigrants even today, right? To be accepted but still have that identity as an outsider kind of highlighted. And I think we could even think about it in terms of sort of a model minority, right? She's being held up as a very good Moabite. But against a backdrop where we know that maybe that's not the expectation, right? That most Moabites are considered poorly, right? But she's a good one. So we might think of this as encoding some difficulties, right? At the same time that she's significantly included, there's ways in which she's still an outsider, even in chapter 4, where she's, I think, three times called Ruth the Moabite over and over.
Mm-hmm. Also, Moabites who were brought into the wives of Jacob and become, you know, the mothers of Israel.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So there's something to be said for being a Moabite, perhaps.
Well, I think that it's absolutely true that there are plenty of foreigners in the history of Israel and Judah as we read it in the Hebrew Bible. And I think that Ruth is often read, rightly so, as a counterpoint to some of the more xenophobic passages that we find in the Bible that are more suspicious of foreigners, right? We can think of Ruth as providing sort of an alternative story and an alternative voice. At the same time, Ruth is still identified sometimes as an outsider in various ways, even though she's very much included and admired. Even the note that Naomi actually nurses Obed, the child, can some people read it as a note that encodes sort of that Naomi has inducted him into Israelite ethnicity, because in some cultures, breast milk is thought to sort of convey ethnicity, which is an interesting thought that we don't usually, I think of now, but so we can read this as sort of a story of how Ruth is included, and then we can also read this as a story in various ways that Ruth is still excluded or still considered an outsider, right? So, turning from that, I think, well, I'll ask final questions or thoughts on this theme of how Ruth depicts people navigating both ethnic and religious boundaries. It's a great question.
I would think that she would have converted.
Ah.
Or whatever that was, been baptized, whatever.
Well, yeah, this is an interesting question. So actually, Brian Rainey talks about, he's a scholar who talks about race and ethnicity in the Hebrew Bible. And something he actually talks about is that ethnicity is sometimes, religion is seen as a component part of ethnicity in a lot of ancient texts. And so for Ruth to choose to be worshiping the God of Naomi, worshiping the God of Israel and Judah, is to make sort of a significant statement. Yeah, so I think we should read her as worshiping their God. And at the same time, she is still called the Moabite, even in chapter 4, right? So I think we could also talk about these tensions in modern stories of conversion, right? That it's not always quite as simple as just changing identity all at once, right? And there's also an element where other people might continue to see someone as an outsider in certain ways. So I don't want to emphasize that she's an outsider too much. I want to sort of balance it with these ways that she's significantly included and also ways that maybe she's still held a little bit at arm's length.
Mm-hmm. What about your
Absolutely. Yes, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So she has claimed Naomi's God as her own, right? She's traveled to Naomi's homeland. She's made it her own homeland. Absolutely. All right. So I want to think about another set of themes within Ruth, and that's how Ruth and Naomi can sort of navigate gendered opportunities and constraints. So what are some of, from your reading of Ruth, what are some of the gendered constraints on Ruth and Naomi as they navigate, particularly after chapter one when they're on their own, or in the middle of chapter one when they're on their own? Yeah, gleaning seems to be their option to earn income, right? We could say that their economic situation is constrained by their gender. It's kind of unclear what this parcel of land that's mentioned later in the story, what the possibilities are for them there, but gleaning seems to be their opportunity.
Ruth was not supposed to be in the threshing
room. Yeah, there's some... Yes, the threshing floor seems to be a men's place. Boaz says, no one can know that a woman was here, right? And let's spin this out a little more. What are some of the other risks for Ruth being at the threshing floor?
Well, when she's talking to Boaz about gleaning, he says to his guys, mm-hmm. Get your hands off of her.
Yes.
She's not just like one of the other servants.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. In chapter 2, verses 8 and 9, Boaz invites her to keep gleaning at his fields, and he says, I've instructed the young men not to bother you, which we could sort of read quickly and not notice, but there seems to be a threat there, right? That perhaps gleaning could be a dangerous thing. Perhaps being at the threshing floor could be a risky move, not just reputationally, but also for her safety. Yeah, I think that there's ways in which we could say that if she's a Moabite, people might feel like she's an outsider and thus less protected, right? She's not clearly attached to a patrimonial household in the town, right? Her and Naomi are kind of on their own, which presents them with some opportunities, right? But also is a risk, right? They're not sort of attached to a household, a larger household with maybe more power to protect or defend them. Mm-hmm. Other possible constraints before we move to opportunities?
Well, making the move to uncover the feet felt to go from gleaning to like showing up and kind of making herself available in a very different kind of way felt like...
Yeah! Yeah, showing up to the threshing floor, uncovering Boaz's feet, which we know that feet in the Bible can be feet, and they can be other things too. So this is kind of a sexy scene, no matter how you read it. I was looking, some of the study notes in some study Bibles very clearly say, well, nothing happened. And I'm not sure how they're saying that, because I think we don't know, right? It's a very elusive kind of scene that doesn't sort of give us the specifics of what happened that evening, but it's a sort of sexy scene that we have.
Well, it's funny, because when we were talking about it leading into today, it's like you almost want to read it as a rom-com because they end up together at the end, but there's also this like kind of underlying threat that it, like,
yeah.
Depending on like the lens through which you read it, it's like, look, and like they had a meet cute like out like in the field, and then this thing happens, but like actually, like,
yes,
super dangerous.
Right. Yeah. So reputationally, I think there's this element of like physical safety and danger in this men's space late at night, and then there's also this reputational issue, right? So one of the chapters in my book, and something I focus on a lot, is sex work in the Bible and the ancient world. And I actually think that Ruth and Naomi are very distinctly acting in secrecy to avoid the appearance of sex work, right? So they're an autonomous household. There's no, there is usually in the Hebrew Bible an expressed preference for household control over women's sexual decision making, right? Fathers and parents are involved in helping decide marriages and things like that. But Naomi and Ruth have autonomy from any other household. So it seems like within the story, sex work would be one option for them, but they're acting in a way, right, to try to attach themselves to a patrimonial household instead. And so that's, I think, part of the reason for this secrecy, because there's a desire to sort of avoid the appearance of exercising too much sexual autonomy, right? So let's use that as a point of transition. How do Naomi and Ruth express agency and autonomy in this story? Yeah.
She's using that sort of as a bargaining chip. You can have the land, but Ruth goes with
it. Yeah, it seems like Naomi might be using some sort of land inheritance as a bargaining chip to help get Ruth married. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're choosing to migrate, and then they're choosing to migrate together back from Moab to Bethlehem. That's a really significant choice that both of them, we could say they make together, right? Absolutely.
They have a plan.
Yeah, they make a plan, right? I notice in this story they choose who they're going to try to get Ruth together with, right? Someone who seems friendly, someone who seems rich, right? They don't just kind of go for the first option. They choose a strategic option. And I think this is an important way to think about, as it's an important reading strategy for me for thinking about women in the Hebrew Bible and women in the ancient world, is that if we look for constraints and oppression, we'll probably find them. And if we look for agency and autonomy, we'll probably also find those, right? It's sort of a balance. In different stories, they might be weighted in different ways, but these stories are sort of always a little more complicated than a simple story of either just opportunity or just constraints, right? So let's talk about one final thing that's we could think of maybe in terms of both opportunity and constraint. Let's talk about childbearing in this story. How is it an opportunity? How might we think of it as a constraint?
I'm not sure it's on point, but I wanted to note that Boaz is an older man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Childbearing might have been a risk at that point. I don't know how much older he is than she is.
Oh, sure.
There might have been some risk associated with that, but there's also obviously some autonomy and agency as we point out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, childbearing in and of itself in the ancient world and even in the modern world carries some risks, right? We could think about the connection to the genealogy as an important opportunity, right? That's one of our most important ways that we can say Ruth is included as an insider, right? She's included in this important genealogy. And at the same time, the genealogy at the very end in chapter 4, 18 through 22, does anyone have a Bible with them and willing to read it aloud for us? Because I want to ask what you notice about this genealogy. Thanks, Isabella.
This then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Aminadab.
Just go. Yep. Yeah.
Yep. Aminadab the father of Nahshon. Nahshon the father of Salmon. Salmon the father of Boaz. Boaz the father of Obed. Obed the father of Jesse. And Jesse the father of David.
Anybody notice anything about that genealogy? I see you saying it. Yeah, there's only men in this genealogy, right? We have men begetting men, right? So at the same time that childbearing can be a key path to esteem, right? A key path to Ruth's full inclusion, a sign of her full inclusion. We can also see ways in which women are sort of sometimes scooted out of the story of childbearing in the Hebrew Bible. And we have these sort of series of begats full of men. And another thing, not to downplay it, is that I think motherhood, again, can be a role. It's tricky. We don't want to define women only by childbearing, right? But we can also recognize that motherhood was an important site of authority in both ancient and modern families, right? Sometimes mother is used as a title of respect, just like father could be used as a title of respect for people who are not related. So it can be seen as a title of authority. So as we're thinking about some of the themes of Ruth, I want to turn this back over to you for a few minutes, for 5 minutes, maybe get into groups of 3 or 4 people. And I want you to think about, if you're going to publish Ruth, where and how would you publish it? What considerations would you make about genre, tone, etc.? And how would you market it to an audience? And who would be your primary audience? So I've presented a couple of themes for us to think about. There's so many more interpretations of Ruth, so there's no right or wrong answer to this question. But I want you to explore how you would think about publishing this. And then we'll have some groups share after about 4 or 5 minutes. Okay, so maybe one more minute with your groups, and then we're going to return and maybe hear a few pitches for how people are going to present Ruth, how you would present Ruth. Okay, are any groups excited about... I should...
Yes.
All right.
Okay. Two gray-haired people, so we chose a periodical.
Oh!
A periodical is O, because we think Oprah would be all about supporting these kinds of women.
Mm-hmm.
We would publish this in...
Speak into the mic, please.
I am.
There you go. Okay, so they're going to publish this in periodical with Oprah.
In the magazine O, Oprah would support women finding their way.
Mm-hmm.
We thought we would publish this in installments, and we would try to stop at suspenseful points along the way. And we decided that the theme or the genre would be all about, as an outsider, making a plan, executing that plan, and carrying it forward.
Absolutely. And who would your audience would be readers of O magazine?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Other groups?
Women. Empowering women.
Yeah.
We saw two different routes that this could go. One is what Thais was alluding to, kind of the romantic comedy, but maybe not comedy, but sort of the happily ever after. You know, romance is the number one selling type of book now.
Yeah.
And so there's some beautiful, like, graphic designs on the front of romance, modern romance novels, not the sort of dated pictures we think of. So that would be one route to kind of buff out some of the grittier parts. Or you could go the literary fiction a la Elena Ferrante, include all the details, include all the stress and the trauma, and we couldn't quite decide which would be more appealing to people.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other, maybe a couple of other groups who want to share your...
We conjured up a little novella on social media with a little bit of video.
Ooh.
And a series of little events, you know, the mystery of the thrashing room.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, surviving in spite of the community, rejection of them, perhaps. And sort of international intrigue and dealing with the foreigners. And
so if we're using sort of new media, social media to put it out, maybe your audience is younger people especially.
Yep.
Not that everyone can use social media.
Complete
but.
With drum rolls.
Drum rolls, excellent.
So our group sees this as a children's book.
Okay.
Probably illustrated by Charles Schulz. Because you can use cartoon characters to teach very deep truths about life.
Yeah.
And so we would be marketing it to parents.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we turn it into a chancel drama.
Excellent. Do you have maybe one or two deep truths that the children's book would zero in on? Okay, fair enough. Any other groups have a pitch for Ruth to share?
We explored the idea of a Netflix series.
Excellent.
And the target would probably be women in their reproductive years, like 20 to 40, something like that, primarily. Mm-hmm. And we thought it could be a very long series because we could start out with a prequel that gives history of the Hebrews and the Moabites, and it could end with Jesus.
Oh, well, that is indeed quite a long series. Yeah, and I think... something that's interesting about the Book of Ruth, right? We have this focus on Ruth, a young woman, and then we also see Naomi, an older woman, really at the front of this story as well, which is in just like in our media today, not something that we always see in biblical stories either, a focus on older women. So thank you everyone for considering these, considering how you would publish and think about the Book of Ruth. As I said, I think there's so many other ways to read it as well that we didn't end up talking about today. There's lovely queer readings of Ruth and the relationship between Naomi and Ruth. There's readings that focus more on Naomi as the main character of Ruth and things like that. But since we have limited time, for my final thoughts on Ruth, I wanted to say that Ruth is a book about the complexities of navigating ethnic and religious boundaries, the complexities of economic precarity and social sexual mores. And it is a book about women's friendship, a sexual drama, and their successful marriage intrigues. It's both. And I want us to return, as you think about the Book of Ruth as you leave today, to thinking about how Ruth fits into the canon and how this book can stretch our understanding of the canon or even challenge it. So with that, thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Friends, I hope you come back next week. Joseph Kwan is gonna be talking about Queen Esther, another riveting female-led drama in the Old Testament. So we hope to see you next week.
That one ends with a lot of murder, though. Well, not necessarily the story, not necessarily the lesson he's doing.
Sorry. Nope, not next week, guys. Oh. Next week is Sarah and Hagar. Sorry, Jonathan, didn't want to like obscure it. Sarah and Hagar next week, also a female-led drama, but we're just powering through. Thanks, everybody.
Yes.